you're playing this game with a self-knowledge and you're doing it in a way that should it all go to zero, you can A, look at your personal finances and feel like, okay, you know what? I enjoyed it. I treated this like a hobby or some form of entertainment. But also, you know, you look at your collection and say, I'm really happy with what I'm holding and I'll wait it out. You know, these things work in cycles. And,
right,
you know, what we've seen in terms of the fundamentals of the entire space, it's not going anywhere. It's just a matter of what will happen with this first huge wave of wealth generation. How sustainable will that be? And what does Act 2, 3, 4 look like?
That was Chris. I don't want to disclose his last name. He wants to keep that private, but he's a member with me over at Flamingo DAO. And at Flamingo, we do these weekly Zoom calls where we discuss, you know, all the latest and greatest NFT projects. And Chris is that person on the call that I feel is just so good at identifying the next big thing. We've all had that friend. They find the band before it becomes massive. He's that for NFTs. So you're going to hear about some of the wilder NFT projects in this episode, like this new trend of combining NFTs to make new and unique NFTs by burning certain NFTs, which is crazy, as well as NFTs that are at the intersection of fashion and identity. And we do some rapid fire questions that cover his favorite art blocks projects, favorite virtual land, and some up and coming artists. I think you're going to like this one. Let's chat with Chris. So, Chris, it is an honor to have you on the show. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Kevin. It's an honor to be on the show.
You know, one of the things to give folks a little bit of a background here, we are on the Flamingo DAO together. You are on a handful of really well-known and respected DAOs like the Lao and Neptune DAO. One of the things that we do every week on Flamingo DAO is we do these weekly calls and, you know, it's kind of updates, industry trends, talking about, you know, purchases that we want to make. And one of the things that quickly stood out to me in kind of the newbie to the group joining just a few months ago was how insightful and deep you are in the NFT space. And I think that's one of the things that makes Flamingo so unique is we have a great kind of bottoms-up economy of folks that are able to bring up any topic and suggest new and interesting projects. And I really enjoy your insights. And so I wanted to have you on the show so that we could just take some of that secret sauce behind the scenes that you do on the Flamingo side and just expose folks to your thinking around all things NFT.
Cool. And yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. The Flamingo crowd is awesome. And the weekly calls are just, you know, such a wealth of knowledge and people to talk to and form opinions in the space. I mean, there are just so many good people on those calls. And it's something I really look forward to participating in.
Yeah, you and me both. It's like when I get on those calls, there's always like a project or two I've never heard of. And so just because we can't cover everything, like no individual can cover everything that's going on in this space. And so I'm always learning something new. And that's a lot of fun for me. But first, I guess a great place to start would just to be how you got into this crazy world. But what's your background?
Yeah, great question. How did I get in this crazy world? So I've been doing, you know, consumer tech most of my working life. I went to school for marine biology, which is a, you know, a great place to learn about technology. It did some financial services, but then, you know, it was like 1999 and the internet was born, and it was something I hopped into, you know, lived through the whole dot-com crash, worked in the space out in LA, you know, until about 2006. At that point in time, I moved to New York and my stock options came in and I was able to afford an apartment in New York. So
that's a tough thing to do, man. I've been there.
Yeah, it was a big moment. And, you know, my wife is one of those people who just loves New York and always wanted to be there. So, you know, that's where we went. And I was actually like moments away from taking a gig at Citi and building out their web analytics team. And I kind of, you know, it was an interesting opportunity, but it wasn't something I really wanted to be doing. And I got a call out of the blue from a friend of a friend who had, you know, a telco thing going that was blowing up and needed help. And so I said, hey, you know, I'll jump in and help you out. And, you know, it'll be a cool thing to do for 6 months. You know, that partnership is still ongoing to this day. And, you know, me and a group of people built several companies together in the mobile space. And, you know, that was something I really enjoyed, you know, startup scaling the whole nine yards, but it eventually, you know, it did take a toll and I needed to, you know, step away and I wanted to find something new. You know, when you work in certain industries, you're reinventing, you know, the mousetrap over and over again. And I just wanted to find something that was greenfield. And it took some time, you know, but Ethereum was something I've been following, you know, since 2016, but it had been primitives for so long. And I really do more, you know, stuff on the consumer end. And, you know, finally, like, I think I was looking at it, you know, fall 2019, and it was like, hell, you know, this is getting to that point. And I really, you know, started digging in, you know, that in 2020, early 2020. And, you know, I was just looking for the right opportunity, the right entry point. And that's when the Lao came along. And I was like, wow, this looks great. It's, you know, be a way to know people in the space, build a network, but also be able to explore a lot of these projects. And I had no idea, you know, really what I was in store for or what the Lao would go on to be and to, you know, form out of it. I mean, you know, people who don't know, Flamingo DAO was spun out of the Lao. And so, yeah, I mean, the journey into NFT land was really done collectively within the Lao as we looked at, you know, early projects that we were going to support, things like Super Rare, Avagochi, you know, and then as we continued to explore the world, we realized, you know, we needed to have a vehicle that instead of, you know, investing in projects could acquire assets. And and so, you know, that's how Flamingo came about, and really getting in, you know, us forming Flamingo and just exploring the space together was my exposure to it.
That's awesome. So you were in Flamingo from day one. Did everyone from the Lao move over to Flamingo, or was it kind of one of those things where, because your mandate at the Lao was crypto projects, right? Like DeFi, like things that are kind of not NFTs. And I'm assuming at some point NFTs started popping up on your radar and you said, hey, let's create this other side thing. How many folks jumped over?
So the Lao itself has a stake in Flamingo, right? So we allocated funds to form it. And so, you know, the entire Lao are collectively members of Flamingo, but then I'd say about half of membership jumped over, you know, into Flamingo. And so that, you know, when we launched, we might have been 30-ish people, you know, who were kicking Flamingo off.
Gotcha. Awesome. Do you remember what the first Flamingo purchase was by chance? I'm just out of curiosity because it's such a legendary DAO now.
I do. I actually made the first and second Flamingo purchases on behalf of the DAO. And so the first one is Somnium Space. We were really geeking out on, I mean, the first time we talked to Arthur and the Somnium team, it was just a mind blower. You know, like he was on a Zoom call with us in Somnium Space, and it was a sense of nested realities. You know, that you're on your laptop on Zoom, and he's on Zoom, but he's in the metaverse on Zoom with you. So, you know, that was our first buy. We bought an XL plot in a really nice location that, you know, we're building out right now. And then the second one was very fitting as well because, you know, we're massive generative art nerds. And so it was Nate Alex's Squiggly WTF project.
Can you explain what the squiggly, because so many people think squiggly and they think, you know, Chromie squiggles from art blocks. What was the squiggly WTF?
Yeah, so Squiggly WTF, it's a generative art project where all the output is SVG. And so, you know, the whole project is stored on chain and then the output is rendered, you know, as SVG files in your browser. And it's a little bit abstract. It's a lot of like shape driven shape-driven art that looks really cool. Yeah, I'm not doing it justice, but it was something where, you know, we'd never seen anything like that before. You know, I think we're still learning, you know, the history of generative art and autoglyphs. And Squiggly had the good fortune of being a project, you know, a gen art project that was live at the time that we were just getting going. And, you know, in my mind, it has this really important place in the history, because I think it, you know, I view it as the bridge between glyphs and art blocks. And I think a lot of people who are coming into the space in the fall of last year, you know, that was the project that, you know, introduced them.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what are the things that when you look at, I mean, so much has happened. I feel like NFT time, if crypto time is like this compressed, like just rapidly evolving, I feel like things are happening even faster on the NFT front. At least that's the way it seems in my head. What's your current kind of state of the union thoughts on the overarching NFT space? It just seems, you know, tooling is getting easier. So there's more artists coming onto the scene. There's just more and more projects. Are we, obviously we're in a crazy bull cycle right now. Would you agree with that?
Yes, for sure.
I'm worried. And I will say I'm worried not in the blue chip stuff that is, you know, meaningful. And we could define what that means to be a blue chip kind of NFT and have something that was a first, but I'm more worried about just so many people these days aping into, you know, the next, well, ape project or whatever it may be with insert glasses, insert hat, you know, like there seems to be a lot of copycats out there. We just love your take on all of that. And what are the most interesting pieces of the entire NFT ecosystem that you're excited about? And which ones you're worried about as well?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there's so many directions we can go with that. I guess I'd start by saying, you know, NFTs to me are about participation, and they're, you know, their success and the way they took off. I believe it was a result of a lot of people who wanted to take part in Ethereum, but, you know, they weren't quants, they weren't coders, and DeFi isn't something, you know, that comes naturally to a ton of people. And so, mm-hmm. you know, in a lot of ways to me, NFTs are about, you know, unlocking this desire to participate in this community. You know, that being said, yeah, it's run away so fast and it's blown up so big. I do have my concerns. You know, I'm broadly bearish on PFPs, profile pictures, you know, avatar projects. I think that's the place that, you know, is really kind of ripe for a crash. And a lot of that is, you know, because it's so much of it is derivative or it's mm-hmm. low effort. And it's really, you know, does have this gold rush mentality to it. And so I do view that as an area of concern. You know, obviously there's super strong projects coming out of it. And, you know, you look at things like Bored Apes, I mean, Punks, obviously, you know, but even some of the newer projects, you know, they will last and they will have legs, but dozens, you know, for every one, there'll be dozens that won't make it. And so, you know, that's one I think you really ought to tread carefully on. Art Blocks is mind-boggling. You know, God, it is such a good project. You know, Snowfro is such a great guy. There's so much talent coming out of there. But at the same time, the hyper-capitalization, you know, of Art Blocks and NFTs in general, you know, it does set itself up, you know, for a fall. I mean, you know, we've been through these cycles, you know, early internet, ICOs, you know, housing crisis, you name it. You know, the history does kind of show that these things have to crest and then crash at some point. But, you know, hopefully we won't see too big of a pullback, you know, just because of the number of people who continue to come into the space. And the way I view it is if you're playing in the NFT world, it's really important that you're comfortable with who you are, what you have available to you, and just in terms of your financial wherewithal, and that you're playing this game with a self-knowledge and you're doing it in a way that should it all go to zero, you can A, look at your personal finances and feel like, okay, you know what? I enjoyed it. I treated this like a hobby or some form of entertainment. But also you look at your collection and say, I'm really happy with what I'm holding, and I'll wait it out, and if it comes back, great. And, you know, these things work in cycles. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we've seen, I think, from in terms of the fundamentals of the entire space, it's not going anywhere. It's just a matter of what will happen with this first huge wave of wealth generation. How sustainable will that be? And what does Act 2, 3, 4 look like?
Right. And we're even seeing little micro corrections within communities. Remember when MeBits launched, everything was selling, the floor for a new mint was around 2.5 ETH. A lot of people got free MeBits because they had a CryptoPunk and they could mint one for one and get a free one there. So we saw the floor fall out and get down to sub 1 ETH, and then things bounce back and it's now back up again. So we're seeing there's a lot of that, a little fluctuations that happen, and they can be meaningful at times. And then some of the more credible projects will bounce back. I'm curious, with MeBits and with Apes and some of the others, what are the attributes that you see that will, one, grab your attention in terms of there being enough of a community and enough of interest to where you're like, okay, this is something I should seriously pay attention to? Because I'll give you an example. For me, I missed Bored Apes altogether. Like, I saw it come out and I was like, that's design-wise, that's not my style. Seems like a knockoff of CryptoPunks. But I wasn't paying attention to the community side, which is a huge piece of this. And then also, I think on top of that, you have to layer on, what are the ambitions of the developers behind it? Is it a one and done? Is it a constant iteration and progression of the project over time? Like, how do you view all of that?
Yeah, great question. I would kind of look at it through a lens of 3 or 4 criteria. I think one is just the initial visceral response you have to a project. Does this look good? Does it resonate with me? Is this something that I can feel a connection to? I mean, I think the eye test is just the, you know, right out of the gate, how you should be looking at it. But then after that, you do get into this realm of what is the community response to it, and where is the market on it? And those two things are often very intertwined. Something can run away very, very quickly, and you can go, all right, well, you know what? I missed it, but there's so many other things out there. And, you know, like Bored Apes, I didn't participate in that one either. And I think it's an amazing project. It's got a super strong community. I happened to be really long on MeBits at the time, and not super liquid. I did have an eye on an ape that I liked. It was a noise for Roman toga and sunglasses. And it was one, I was like, hey, you know what? That's something, like, it appeals to me. I can see myself being represented in it. And yeah, I was waiting for the price to come down, and it just never did. And you can't participate in everything, but there's that community marketing component. And finally, it's the creators and how do they carry a project? It's easy to launch. It's hard to sustain. It's difficult to execute or to continue to show focus or to handle the communications and the expectations in a good way. I mean, it's an entire, you know, skill set beyond creation. And so when you look at these projects, you kind of want them to have that total package of personal appeal, strong community, but then an operating team, you know, who shows that they're going to go somewhere.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's a big piece of it. I'm curious, how do you do your kind of due diligence on that aspect of it? Like, for me, I pop into the Discords. I remember when I was early in the Apes, I went into a clubhouse that they were having, and it wasn't about, one of the big red flags for me is people talking about, oh, let's get these up to this price and I'm going to sell, or whatever it may be, like the pump and dump stuff you want to obviously just completely avoid. But for them, for many of them, at least in the clubhouse I was in, and there was a few hundred people, they were talking about how they had missed out on CryptoPunks, and this was their version of that. This was their way to participate, and they had, that was exciting for them. On the developer front, it's impossible, especially with some of these people being so anonymous, to know kind of what their grand plans are. Sometimes they lay it out on the website, and who knows if they'll actually hit, you know, the milestones that they set forth. But do you go and have one-on-one conversations with these folks, or is it something where you're just kind of doing what I'm doing, where you're poking around in Discords?
Yeah, I do a lot of poking. I do Discord and Twitter are really my big avenues of communication. I'm fortunate that to be in Flamingo, we collectively share a hive mind, and there are plenty of people within Flamingo who are far more social and outgoing and talk to these projects, and you can get that information back. The thing like I particularly hone in on is how a project communicates during adversity. You know, are they out in front? Are they forward in their comms? You know, if they're doing a drop and they didn't realize that they were in a competing window as another project and gas spikes and they went to, you know, deploy their contract and they didn't understand how MetaMask gas works, and you know, you've got 10,000 people in a Discord just popping off. What the heck is going on? Why haven't you dropped? And you're not forthright about that, and you hide behind it. That to me is something that speaks, you know, volumes about, is this a project I want to be in or not? And, you know, that was a specific example I'm referencing. It's not always that dramatic. There are more subtle ways. Are they able to pulse the community? Are they able to keep following through on a roadmap? I mean, there's a lot of ways, you know, in which communication will guide my decisions. And to me, that's something, you know, in my past life, I had to do a lot of channel communications. I had a lot of people who are downline, and that when my services went down, I was affecting their business. And so it's sort of Mike Socha, the angel manager, was always super hard on his catchers because he was a catcher. Like, to me, it's one of those, I was an operator. I've been out there, and that's the thing I kind of personally look in on, but there are a lot of other ways you could do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something that I try to do as well. I think great examples of that, Bored Apes, obviously. The Punks Comics one was one that kind of caught me by surprise. I thought it was initially kind of just like a one and done, and then the roadmap and things that they've decided to add on top of that. It's interesting that there seems to be this trend where you own our Genesis piece, whatever it may be, and then as we do more future drops of other related work, you kind of have access to those as the owner of the first, you know, piece in our collection. We saw that with Bored Apes with the Kennel Club. Punks has done that as well. If you burn a punk comic, do you see that as being a trend that will continue?
I hope so. And because it's a really strong signal, and it's a really good way to do it. If you view your project from a lens of storytelling and development of your own little world, and you're able to do it in a clear manner, in a consistent manner, and you deliver, it's above and beyond the initial expectation. And so there's a moment of joy when you discover, oh, I'm getting airdropped something, and there's that dopamine hit. But it's also, it does speak about the people behind the project. And so, you know, I hope more people continue to view their initial drop not as an endpoint, but as just the start of a journey. And those projects, they will do well long term.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the slightly more geeky emergence of these new NFTs that you kind of burn, or you combine NFTs to create new works? Framergence comes to mind. There's a few others that have launched recently. Is this too geeky? Like, sometimes when I look at these projects and it's like, okay, take two of ours and combine them and it'll output this new thing. And I wonder, 2 decades from now, if people are looking back, will they see it as innovative or just confusing?
Well, A, you're now like in my wheelhouse. If it's too geeky, I'm too geeky, because I love this stuff. This is something that, again, it's about participation, and it's about being able to get in there and continue with an NFT. And so it's not going to be for everyone, for sure.
What do you love? Which one do you love most? These new examples? Like, is Framergence the one that you're really into?
Oh, Frame Origins is my jam.
Okay, tell me, I don't get it. So I would love that Reddit explained to me like I'm five. Can you tell me what Frame Emergence is? I'm sure a lot of people listening have no idea what that is either.
Sure. So Frame Emergence is a project from an Anon artist creator named Ariz. And it released in March. It was a Freedom Mint project in late March. I remember it. You know, because I was with my family, it was spring break and, you know, we were away and it was something I just randomly minted. Saw it on Twitter and it was these little black and white things that basically it was generative art that followed a set of rules around primitives and just output patterns. And it was designed to follow emergent properties in nature, such as fractals. And there's just these black and whites. And so you minted them and you looked at them. And I believe there are 984 of them. And the majority of them don't resemble anything, but some of them do take on shapes. There's a bunch that look like ferns or trees or waves or a snowstorm. Now you can see where the developer, you know, was able to capture sort of like nature's ability to create ordered patterns with complexity through just very simple design rules. And when those shown through, you're like, oh, wow, that's really great. Now, the twist and what really set this project apart was it had a burn to mint mechanic built into it where you can basically take the pieces you have that you don't like and you can destroy them, you can burn them, and they'll be replaced with new ones, but you'll lose one. So for instance, if you had nine, you can burn all nine and you'll get eight back. If you had two, you could burn two and you get one back. And so there's this aspect of deflationary curation where...
Wait a second, I'm kind of confused here. So if you have nine and you burn all of them, you get how many back?
You'll get eight back. So the formula is N minus one.
N minus one. Okay. Gotcha. And so, you're basically saying, okay, this one doesn't look like a tree. This one doesn't look like a fern. It's not something that I'm visually into because these are generative, right? So the output, you never really knew what you're going to get. And you're like, okay, I'll roll the dice. I'll kill off a couple of these and get one back. And hopefully it's better. That's the thinking.
Yeah, that's it right there. Go ahead.
And so you're reducing supply. So you had 984. So out of the 984 that were originally minted, do we know what the current supply is?
We do. Someone set up doing analytics on it. And last I looked, there was about 500 that have been burned or okay. Remaining. It's let's just say plus or minus 10%, half of them are gone. And they've been replaced by new ones.
And so that's the only thing you could do with Frame Emergence. It's just two for one, hopefully you like. And are there attributes that are defined in the blockchain that are rare? Meaning, would there be a tree attribute that's actually in the contract? Or is it something where it's just all about subjective visual taste?
It's elements of both. There is a rarity scheme within the project. And so what you're looking for are single primitive frames, which is basically you only have one output pattern, be it stars or lines or bubbles or circles. So you're looking for a piece that really only has one of those elements on it versus four, because you tend to get really nice clean ones. And then even within those single output patterns, there's a rarity scheme within them. So for instance, I happen to have one of two Grail for Emergences, which is a single prim continuous triangle, which, you know, if you look at it, it's basically just a triangle being drawn and drawn and drawn on itself in like kind of layers of depth. Mm-hmm. And that's the rarest of the bunch. But
crazy. So, wow, this is kind of fun. There's a little hit of gambling here too, right?
Like, oh, yeah. Well, that's
okay. Do I go pick up a bunch of floors? Because I got to imagine that continuous triangle is what, several orders of magnitude higher than a floor?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because no one's ever listed or sold one. So the ultimate value of it is unknown. But the market mechanics behind the project are also really interesting because the project was getting discovered. And so the floor kept running up at the same time that these primitives were on market. And so the floor would quickly run up to the value of the print, the single prims. And so you could never get a great fixed value, but there was also that gambling mechanic that you mentioned as well in there. And so we're now just kind of hitting the point where the floor is, you know, it's maybe 3 ETH right now. It varies, but it's kind of gotten away from the individual to go out there and just, you know, buy a bunch and burn a bunch and look for something. And so now a lot of it's, you know, being done within the community. There's an emergence DAO that's formed where like 84 emergences were donated into the DAO, and we're all going to collectively choose which ones to burn, which ones to keep. And so to be able to continue in that curation mechanic as a group, because the market price, I mean, when I was doing this on my own, it was like $100 or something, you know, to buy a frame to burn it. And
right.
And now it's, if I can't burn like several thousand.
9 or 10K worth of, yeah.
Yeah.
It would be double that, right? Because you have to have two, well, you're getting one back. So yeah.
But yeah. And so that's a great project. That's
cool. So that was the first, right? Like, I don't think I've ever heard of that particular mechanic done prior to this. Is that right?
As far as I know, I mean, it's impossible to ascertain what was the definitive first of anything, but it was definitely, in my mind, where it first caught on and first built a community of pyros who all wanted to A, play the game, but B, kind of collectively turn an initial output into something that was smaller, but also better looking.
Oh man, this would be a killer extension for Artblocks, wouldn't it? Imagine if every Artblocks project had this mechanic.
Yeah.
That could be epic.
It totally would be. I mean, if you took the Chromie squiggles, you had started with 10,000 squigs, and fast forward 5 decades, and we live in a world where there's only 50 hypers left, and the last, you know, to burn a regular squiggle would be billions of dollars, or, you know, something absolutely ridiculous. But I mean, those sort of games could be played, and I mean, just in the Artblocks economy, which, you know, itself is just blown up so big, it would certainly happen on a much more consequential scale, and a lot of eyes would be on that.
Yeah. After Framergence, they released a second project, correct?
Yes, which was Pulse Squares, and that project was claimable for frame holders. And Aries, you know, he started teasing it out on Twitter, and I saw it and was just like, oh my God, this looks so good. Because Pulse Squares, it's in color, it's animated, it goes through basically how you can take sequences of squares and through kind of driving mathematical formulas underneath the pattern, you can create kaleidoscopic effects. You can create all sorts of different patterns through rotating them, through making them big, making them small, putting different color palettes on it. And I was just like, oh, I can't wait for this. And when a drop is coming, you got to ask yourself, am I going to live my life or am I going to be held hostage to a drop? And I feel like this dropped in May when I was just tuning up my golf game, and I had a weekly game going. You know, and I was like, Murphy's Law, I'm going to be out golfing and this thing's going to drop. And it totally did. And it looked great and it was fantastic. And so I missed it and I had to, you know, get back in through secondary.
So what's the mechanic behind this one?
Yeah, so in this one, the mechanic there is that you can create a constellation that orbits the border of your pulse square. So pulse squares they sit in a rectangular frame, and they're either squares or diamonds, the actual art inside. And so what you could do is you could burn either another pulse square or a Framergence into your piece, and it would live on as a little constellation that orbits around the border.
Crazy. So you could take one of your continuous triangles and drop it around the outside of a pulse square.
Yes. And
not that you would want to do that, but who knows what that does to the value. Has anyone, what's happening there on the value side?
Yeah. So there are some pulse squares with a serious sunk store value within them. I believe one's called Chad or Alpha Chad, that, you know, there's 8 or 20 pulse squares burned inside of it. And
oh, wow. So you can do unlimited pulse square burns. Wait, you can do unlimited pulse square burns for as a frame of a pulse square?
So you can basically, you can put any pulse square into another one. And then it just looks like a little dot that starts orbiting around. You can also put any frame in there. Yeah.
But you can also put them on the inside as well, or no? Did I get that wrong?
No. They're just represented as little dots that orbit around the frame. But then you can click down into the contract and you can view all the old pieces that have been subsumed into this. So you can see what's been placed inside and no longer exists on its own.
When you do those placements on inside and now they're rotating around the outside, are those cumulative? Or are they just replaced by the most recent one that you burned into it? Meaning, are you seeing a more complex frame as you add and burn more pole squares into the frame?
You're just seeing more and more of them. So if you burn one, you get one that orbits. If you burn two, you have two. And so you can tell, how much value art has been sunk into the piece by the number of these little, circles that orbit around the frame.
Is there a maximum number that you can burn into the frame?
No, you could keep going.
Wow. So that's very difficult to figure out how you'd value something like that.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think we've actually seen the full value appreciation on those. I believe the most expensive pulse square is sold for about 25 ETH that has others buried inside of it. But, I think people are always looking back as history develops and revaluing things. And so one day someone may value one of these pulse squares, not only on the merits of the primary one, but all of the other ones that have been sunk into it.
So I see what you're into. You love this weird kind of mathy, crazy contract stuff. Would you say that's kind of like your favorite type of like crypto art?
I like art that I can have a ongoing involvement with, some form of participation. And so, that mechanic where if a piece asks me to interact with it or the piece is available for future collaboration, and that's really interesting to me. It kind of keeps that relationship going.
And what's this new one that has just now come out with these squares and people are trying to kind of arrange them?
But yeah, that's the one that we're geeking out about in Flamingo. UBI promoter brought that one in yesterday. And so with this one, and I think this is a trend that is going to grow. I think people want to be able to interact with art and share art. And so with this one, as it moves from wallet to wallet, a pixel within the square, I want to say it's a 4x4 grid. I'm not quite sure what the dimensions are. It's either 4x4 or 8x8. Looks like it's 4x4. So you get 16, pixels to fill in this square. And as it moves from contract to contract, the art reads the wallet address and determines what color pixel it could be. And so by selectively transferring that piece of art through your friends or through a DAO, you're basically deciding how that one's going to get filled in, and you're generating the piece through your coordinated acts.
So are you generating just one pixel, or do more pixels emerge on that NFT, or how does that work?
Yeah, so picture it's a blank white rectangle, and the first time you put it in, I think the top left fills in with one color.
Mm.
And then depending who you send it to, it's just going to kind of run clock left to right, top to bottom, and fill its way in. So if you want to plot that out and do a little research, you can ultimately make a design out of that by who you send it to.
So how do you lock it in though? When you say make a design, if I'm just transferring it to someone else and then the color changes, wouldn't that mess up my design?
No, you're adding a second block. Yeah. So picture it as a white grid, white 4x4 grid, right? When you interact with it the first time, it fills a color in. Let's say
the upper left is yellow, okay? And then I send it to you. The second block over is red. There's no way to change that red because the next person's going to be the third block over, right?
Yeah. What you can do, however, is you can kind of check ahead of time what color it's going to be. You can submit a wallet address and go.
Oh, crazy. So you have to find a wallet address that's compatible with that color.
Yep.
And then, so in some sense, you'd have to generate a bunch of wallet addresses. Let's say you're trying to draw something and you're like, okay, I need a purple. Like, I'm going to have to go and generate wallet addresses until I find one that's compatible with purple before I send it to that address.
Yeah. Or you got to have a group of trusted friends or be in an organization where you can all say, hey, I checked my wallet. It's going to be this color. Yours is going to be that color. How do we want to pass it around?
Wow. And then once you get to the very end, it's done. It's locked.
Yes. As far as I know, okay. That's it. But, you know, like these things come at you so fast. I literally, one of the people in Flamingo popped it up yesterday. And I don't know anything beyond what I just told you.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why it's so hard for me to keep track of all the chaos. it seems to be that there's a new crazy, geeky, and this is kind of like, I'm just trying to figure out which of these has, to your point about the community and like long-term, like, because the one thing that's if you're an artist, it's very subjective, but it's something that you can look at. But if you're a coder, you can geek out and go and create all kinds of wild things in different interactions. So it's not like you're just working with brushes and a palette here. It's just you're limited to the math that you're writing, or there could be so many different ways to slice and dice this. It's going to be hard, at least it is for me, to figure out long-term what's going to be considered important versus just a fun game. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's part of the adventure and part of the fun. I think there's a certain class of work that you can kind of objectively say right now, this has staying power, and this is kind of an elite output from an emerging category of art. I think we could say that about what Dimitri's done with Ringers, you know, Tyler with Videnza, you know, Def Beef. I think there's certain ones of these that you know, but mm-hmm. Everything else, yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's also, that's part of the reason why I'm excited to do more podcasts, is because it allows me to have these conversations with these artists and kind of like, they're just kind of suss out what their motivations are, what drives them, what's versus is it just someone that's just doing it for, I don't know what the wrong motivations would be, but I hope I can get a little bit more depth there when I do these interviews. So it's going to be fun to do. Any other things in this general genre that you would like to call out? Or I do want to ask you some questions about your favorite art blocks projects. And then also I'd love to cover, I know you're into metaverses as well. Where would you like to take it?
Yeah. I mean, art blocks is great. I'm super excited to talk about that. I do want to talk about scarcity and abundance for a second. Let's do that, because that's a hobby horse of mine. You know, what we talked earlier about, is this bull market going to end? How is it going to end? And I always look at it in terms of scarcity, where a lot of these projects are deriving value through creating top-down scarcity, right? They're saying I'm going to make a set of 10,000. Of these 10,000, 10 are going to be the most rare, 25 are going to be a level above that, and then everything else might just be whatever. And we see so many of these projects doing that, and if everything is scarce, then nothing is going to be scarce. So at a certain point mm-hmm. in time, the trick or the FOMO or that wanting to win the lottery, you're just going to be, you say to yourself, well, there's another one coming down the road. And so that's something that, like, and that's why I don't play super deep in the PFP space. Winning the lottery is great, but I'd rather, you know, play in projects where you may have an abundant set of resources, and through collective coordinated work, everyone can come together and create something that's scarce. I don't participate in Axie, but I look at Axie as an embodiment of that, in that anyone can play Axie. The entry point into Axie is very low. It's very simple. At the end of the day, though, there's only one Axie. Only one project has reached that level of volume and affected and changed so many lives through the P2E model. And that's the result of this collected, coordinated work. So not anyone not any project can make an Axie. It took that entire ecosystem and all those players coming together to build something special. And so that's something I really get excited about. And if the space is going to keep growing and you're not going to burn people out, that's a model I'd like to see more and more projects switch to, where anyone can get in. It's, and if you missed it, if you weren't awake at the moment of that drop, you can still get in. But then you can, through work, through participation, through a good community vibe, you build up something that's special and that everyone shares in.
Yeah. Is there anything else like that on your radar?
No, I think we will see that in metaverses and in gaming. If you look at Voxels, Voxels is a place where there are vibrant neighborhoods, there are big events, there's a good community, and Voxels doesn't have a hard cap on the amount of space. Like, they will keep making more land, and obviously the older neighborhoods and the more happening neighborhoods are more expensive to buy at this point in time, but no one's ever shut out from Voxels. And if you can't afford land, you can still drop in your avatar, you can still attend all those events. And so that's an example. I mean, Apes, they're doing pets. Let's see how they continue to kind of create these yield-bearing NFTs that other people could get down the line. But that model is still emerging. I think it's going to take a long time till we get to that point of composability, where composing things, you can freely or cheaply pick them up, but only through time and work can you transform them.
Right. Yeah, that is a very cool. I don't know what that is, but you have just enabled a new line of thinking that I'm going to brainstorm around. I get that gut feeling when you're talking about this, like something big is going to be built there, right? And I think it's going to be outside of gaming. Like, someone will do that on the art side, where it's going to require work and you can't enter later in the game. And there is something to be built there. Do you get that same kind of gut feeling? You must, right?
Yeah, no, it's, we're so early in the space and we're still working through patterns and primitives that, I mean, I'm waiting. I expect in the next 6 to 12 months, a project's going to come on market and it's just going to change everyone's perception of what is possible. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's imminent, but we're not quite there yet. But once people see it, it will open a whole set of doors.
Yeah, I agree. Very cool. So I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you're a busy guy. I would love to talk a little bit about your favorite metaverses. I want to go a little deeper there. CryptoVoxels for me is a head scratcher, because outside of events, when I go into the world and I just fly around or walk around or whatever, there's not a whole lot going on. What's going to be the tipping point for metaverses to really take off? Because I think, like VR, in some sense, it all sounds good on paper, but it's I've yet to see. I mean, in some sense, we have had metaverses take off. They're just not really metaverses; they're games, right? That are metaverses. You could probably say Minecraft was kind of the first one like that. What's going to make this really go from tens of thousands of users to millions?
I agree with you about these metaverse experiences right now. So you drop in, and unless an event's happening, maybe you don't see anyone, or maybe it's just some randoms who run right by you. And that's actually what I like about it. I'm probably really in the minority, but I love, like, when I'm walking around an industrial area in a city, if I'm in Long Island City in Maspeth on a Sunday morning and no one's around, or like Greenpoint. And, you know, in Brooklyn, like, I'm really into being in these huge spaces in deserted times. And so for me right now, like, that's a vibe I love. Like, I'm a huge Somnium Space fan. That's sort of my metaverse of choice. And it's, for me, like, what they're trying to achieve through using virtual reality, through kind of really always pushing the limits of graphics, like, they're creating an aesthetic that I really enjoy and I feel comfortable in. But then I also love the fact that I'm strolling through all these houses, or I'm walking through people's neighborhoods and it's empty. And that's not for everyone. That's my own weird little thing. But, you know, that's kind of why, like, one day I'll look back and go, oh, I remember when I could stroll around there and not bump into a single person.
Right, right.
But that's not for everyone. I think for metaverses, you're going to need an entire toolkit to come together, right? Like, we're seeing the actual building out of the virtual space right now, but then you need your audience to be able to come in and fill these spaces, and they need to be able to do it in a little more frictionless in manner than right now. Like I drop into DCL and my laptop can't handle it. I had to buy a separate gaming PC just so I can spend time in the metaverse. Voxels is maybe the friendliest of them, but it still has a load on it. And I haven't quite gotten comfortable in VR yet either. So that part's going to take time. It's going to take a while for us as the users to really get fluid coming in and out of this in a frictionless way. But then you're going to need to be able to bring events and artists and musicians or this cultural aspect into it as well. And they're going to need like social token tooling. They're going to need artist management. They're going to need builders so that if I'm a band and I want to put on a show and I want to do it in one of these spaces, like they don't have that whole package yet. There's, you know, outfits like NFT 42, Jimmy's Crew, or the people who do the WIP meetup and Voxels are capable of this. But, you know, that hasn't been like that cookbook and sort of recipe hasn't been templatized and passed down yet. And so,
yeah.
We're going to need a lot of different things. This is going to be a kind of a slow onboarding as fast as it's happening right now. We may not see a tipping point till 2025, or who knows?
Yeah, that's my take as well. It is there needs to be a lot more tooling and just like less awkwardness around some of the character interactions. And then also, I think a big driver for this is going to be the fun around customizable avatars. Like when I can bring in my MeeBits and I can bring in my, you know, whatever it may be, apes, or and have those as part of my identity, that's going to be pretty huge.
Avatars are super interesting to me because they're this intersection of fashion and identity, which are both huge categories separate on their own, but they really merge at the point of an avatar. And We're in a really primitive state with avatars right now. They're things you try on, or they're toys you play with, and they're clunky. We're going to get to a point where as they become, you know, more fluid and have more utility, they're going to start taking on more and more of this digital identity job that no one in crypto has solved yet either. And so,
yeah.
But look for those, I think, to really come on a lot stronger than they are today. We're just seeing, you know, kind of a ground floor entry into that world.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a series before we wrap, and we'll definitely have to do a second podcast at some point because I have a lot more questions. We could go deeper and go on forever. But to wrap things up, I do have a series of kind of what I hope to be rapid fire questions for you. And we can always skip any if you don't like them. Are you game to do a couple quick questions?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So you can only buy one ArtBlocks project. Which one?
And do I own ArtBlocks yet, or I'm coming up blank?
You don't own ArtBlocks yet. This is your first one, and you want to take into consideration, let's just say, obviously, because we mentioned this at the beginning, the most important thing, especially in bear markets, is that you actually aesthetically appreciate it, right? But also, you're also thinking with an eye towards appreciation of it going up over time. So, given that balance, what are you thinking?
It's ringers then. That's a no-brainer.
Ringers. Interesting. Interesting. That's a tough one. I was going to say what I would have said.
It's not the one I love in my heart of hearts, but if we're kind of balancing all these things out, Ringers is a sure shot.
That's awesome. What's your heart of hearts, just out of curiosity, that you love?
It's Singularity.
Singularity. Very cool. Okay, so big name artist. You have a big budget. You can go out there. You can buy an X copy. You can buy whatever you want. What do you go after?
Ooh, I'm drawing a blank right now.
Do you have any that you love? I mean, are you a fan of like a pack or an X copy or?
Yeah, I love all their works. And I mean, that's the nice thing about the space is like, I love Furocious and I have some additions from them. I love Pac, and unfortunately through Flamingo, we have exposure to Pac. Beeple, great artist, cracks me up. I mean, you know, he's got that social commentary layer. So I've got an addition of each of those, but those aren't true. You know, they're not one of ones, or they're not things I directly own. And so it's a tricky one in that respect, because I don't have a single kind of like digital artist in the crypto space that I long for. It's more like I like to have exposure to a lot of them, but you know, it's like gen art's a little more my jam.
Yeah. Makes sense. Okay, how about land? You have to buy a parcel of land. You think it's going to be the next metaverse. You got sandboxes out there. You got all the ones you've mentioned today. Like where do you buy and take up land?
I take Somnium Space because it's for me personally. It's where I feel most comfortable.
Up and coming artists, any that you like that are out there, or that can even be on the generative side as well?
I'm a huge fan of Cloud Pixel, who's a pixel artist based over in Saudi Arabia. And he's someone who his work just reminds me of my time when I lived in Southern California. It's amazing to see someone who works in pixel art. And I can look at one of their pieces and go, oh, that reminds me of when I visited my uncles in Hermosa Beach. Like, it just takes me straight to a time and a place.
Yes, I'm a fan as well. There's some great pixel artists out there, man. That's a whole nother genre, I think, that's being defined in a very cool way. I love that. I'm curious, last question, platform. Does platform matter to you? So you think of the super rare, do you think super rare is kind of the upper echelon? And then do you consider that to be a factor when purchasing an NFT? Does it add some credibility to the actual purchase?
Yes. And I'm on chain gang. And so for me, if the art is on chain, that is my first criteria. And that may be why, as it relates to digital art, I don't have someone I'd love to have. But, you know, if it's a glyph, if it's a squiggly, if it's an art block, if it's a pulse square, you know, anything that's generated on chain, for instance, Xcopy, you mentioned Xcopy earlier. I recently acquired, and you did too, actually, a pixel chain piece from Xcopy.
Yes.
And, you know, that was something that I really wanted because it was a very important artist, you know, someone really in the space, but doing it, you know, it's not his most dynamic work by any means, but he's doing it in the most crypto native formats. And so that's, for me, it was just like, yeah, that's the Xcopy for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're confined to what, like a 16 by 16 pixel grid or something like that? Like there's not that much space.
Yeah, I mean, it's a primitive pattern, but it looks cool and it's on chain. So, you know, for me, on chain is one of them. Curated platforms, it depends. And some of that has to do with the buy side and whether it's hypey or whether, you know, it's in market for me. I'm not a whale. I don't spend huge amounts of money. So certain platforms, I just know, like, aren't perfect for me. And then, but you know, like super rare is great. Like I like to buy on super rare from time to time. I don't do foundation, for instance. It's one where I think a lot of the net artists and certain things on there just don't quite line up to my style. But then, you know, auctions can run away and I don't compete in that world. I do own a few nifty gateways, but I really don't enjoy that platform. It's not using the best practices in the space. But, you know, I'll do Beeple on there. I'll do Micah Johnson and there's a Coup series. If there's a certain project on there, I will buy over there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Speaking of on-chain, do you ever consider any other chains? I know, obviously, Tezos is making a push in that direction with the HIN platform. Solana has recently had a pretty big drop that sold out instantly and had something like 40,000 people that were interested in it. Are you like Ethereum till you die, or are there other, obviously a ton of weird stuff on Wax?
Yeah.
what do you think about these other chains?
All right. So I'm a have gun, will travel guy. I think it's part of the adventure to go out and to try new chains. There has to be a reason for me though. But I mean, I've got NFTs on XDAI. I was out bridging to Immutable last week in the middle of the night when the Guild of Guardians market dropped on Immutable. And I mean, there's something kind of exciting about being like, oh, I'm going to send 5 ETH over to Immutable. And I don't know if more than a couple hundred people have used this bridge yet, but also, I want my serious stuff living on layer one ETH. I mean, I bridged my Damien Hirst pieces, the currency drop that was on Palm. I brought them over to mainnet because I want them housed in my collection. But B, it's just like certain things, you know, like I think important pieces of art that don't have a functional purpose, you know, operating on a chain like, you know, Polygon-Matic or Immutable or XDAI, you know, I do want them home on layer one ETH.
Yeah. Are you one of these, well, I shouldn't say crazy people, it's probably smart people that go in and pin their own IPFS to make sure that their artwork will always be hosted, even if the actual, you know, main exchange or marketplace goes down? And do you want things on Arweave as well? Do you think about, do you take that into consideration?
And no, I'm not there yet. And maybe if I had some of my high value pieces were, you know, kind of in that state, I'd want to take those actions. But, you know, I'm not, like I said, not super deep into a lot of the digital art where you are relying on a JSON file that points to a hosting somewhere else. I mean, that's, you know, thankfully, like my big pieces are like glyphs and they're art blocks. And so that problem kind of has already been solved for me.
Yeah, it's crazy. I know some collectors that will go in, they read the smart contracts, they look at the JSON file, they say, where is this pointing? If it's pointing to something centralized, someone's domain, they're like, don't want to collect it. If it's pointing to IPFS, they go in and they could do this thing called pinning where you pay to actually ensure the backup storage of it if that node were to go down. Some of them want Arweave because it provides long-term multi-hundred year storage. It's like anything, it's another rabbit hole, right? Like it's funny how geeky people get about this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, it shows they're serious and that they want to have that lasting relationship. So is it extreme behavior? Maybe. Or is it just knowing that a piece is in a good hands?
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Chris, this has been great. It's cool to see that you geek out on a lot of this stuff as I do. Would love to have you back anytime to go deeper because I'm sure we could on a whole slew of different projects. Where can people find you? You know, I know that you live a somewhat kind of private presence. We're not going to use your last name in this interview, but do you tweet a lot? I mean, I follow your Twitter account, so I'm guessing that's the case.
Yeah. So, I mean, Twitter is, you know, the best place to find me. I am on crypto Twitter, just like everyone else on the planet. So if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at ChrisF_0x, number zero, letter X. That'd be me.
Awesome. I will send people that way. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Kevin. This was a blast. I had a great time.
All right. That is the end of the show. One thing real quick before you jump on to the next podcast. We are a brand new show over here at Proof. So if you like the content and you want us to keep producing more, which of course we will, do us a favor, your favorite podcast platform, head on over there, give us a 5-star review. It would be much appreciated. Thanks so much.